Shout out to US Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this episode of One Song and for giving our podcast studio an unbelievably smooth, sustainable makeover. Here on our show, we dive deep into the music, dissecting every beat and lyric. Sustainability is just like that. Each eco-friendly choice we make is like a single note that contributes to life's melody. That's why Heartbeat and the USB are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets. To see our sustainable studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
One, a two, a one, two, three, four.
Here come old One Song, we be talking about music. Gonna talk about Beatles here on Sirius XM. Gonna talk about commerce and art, and hopefully be funny. Wanna thank Kevin Hart. This is One Song. Luxury.
Woo! Yeah, that was amazing.
That was fun.
That was fun.
That was fun. Hey, I'm actor, writer, and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter Luxury, aka the guy who whispers interpolation on TikTok.
So if you haven't guessed it yet, today we are talking about the Beatles, little, you know, underground British group that you might have heard of, and their song, Come Together.
The funny thing about this episode is that, like, this is I can't think of a more culturally big, they've been around for 60 years.
Right.
And that duration is a huge part of their hugeness.
And I feel like there's actually, it's hard to say anything about the group that hasn't already been said, but we're going to try.
Exactly
to
right.
Say some things that get added to the
game. We think we found some cool ways to tell the story.
Yep.
First of all, focusing on just the single song, we're going to play for you some isolated stems, tell you some stories you may not have heard, and talk about why the song is so important to us.
Exactly. Also, why it's so important to us personally.
Exactly.
There's
right.
some personal
exactly
stories.
Right.
There's some personal things we got to get off the chest.
Personal stuff. And like every other episode, we don't really know. We just have some. We're going to talk about some stuff, and the rest of it's spontaneous. I have no idea the stories that Diallo has about the Beatles in
yes.
his life.
Yes.
I'm excited to hear. So, yeah, stay tuned, and we will reveal all.
This is One Song.
You guys ready for a cappella?
I am ready.
All right, here we go. Get ready to freak the fuck out.
Juju eyeball, he won. Holy roller, he got hair down to his knee.
Yeah.
I mean, iconic. Absolutely iconic.
It's like chilling. I say this maybe every episode, and I will never stop, but the word chilling is how I feel when I hear an iconic singer like John Lennon.
Who didn't like his voice, apparently.
Well, you can kind of hear it there where there's effects on his voice. You're right. Every time he recorded, he wanted to hear, as he was recording, he wanted to hear that echo, mm-hmm. the kind of slapback, which in his mind, I think, was an Elvis throwback.
Oh, wow.
And what's interesting, just to take a little rabbit hole there, is that Elvis, when you listen to Elvis and he's got that, like the slapback, it's because in the room there was a speaker and that was also being recorded in the mic.
Uh-huh.
So it's like this accidental...
It's almost like an accidental feedback.
Accidental artifact of history as we associate that delay 50s sound, rockabilly, whatever. And Lennon just adds it using the technology of the day. But you're right, he was uncomfortable with his own voice.
Yeah, and I've also seen that picture of John where he's like, clearly, like, he's really young, John. Like, he's clearly styled to look just like Elvis.
He,
like,
oh my God,
huge
yeah.
Elvis fan.
He loved Elvis. His first band was a rockabilly band.
Yeah.
Or skiffle, I guess, was the name of the genre. Like, skiffle
right.
never made it big in America, but that's like, they were trying to be American. They had washboards and stuff. When Lennon forms the Beatles, it's a skiffle band. So he's obsessed with 50s Americana and Elvis especially.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk plenty about Lennon's vocals later in the show, but I just want to start the show with this. Diallo, what do the Beatles mean to you?
Oh, man. A lot of people don't know this about me now, but anybody who's known me since I was a kid knows this. I was a huge Beatles fan. The first piece of music that I ever bought at a record store was A Hard Day's Night.
What? No way.
I feel like it cost $4.99. At this random record store.
Wait, the first album you bought? What? Like, you bought?
Absolutely. It's the first album I remember actually buying. So my father was a huge jazz record collector. He had something like 3,000 jazz records, and I had a Muppet Show drum set in the basement. And
Animal.
I would sit down there, and I would drum along to his, you know, John Coltrane records, and I even drummed along to, like, the soundtrack to Star Wars. But when it came time for me to buy my first piece of music, there was a cartoon that I used to watch that had, like, the Beatles. And I didn't know it at the time, but the Beatles didn't loan their voices to that cartoon.
I had no idea.
There were a whole bunch of it, but there was, like, a Beatles cartoon. And I used to love them running around on, like, ships. It was very, like, you know.
It was like an unlicensed Beatles
cartoon?
No,
it was licensed.
Okay.
I feel like it's from, like, the Rocky and Bullwinkle era of cartoons. And I would watch that show, and I liked the music. And I bought A Hard Day's Night, and I loved it. I loved that album, and I wore a hole in it. And then I went back and got Please. You know, I got Love Me Do, and I got into, like, the early era Beatles. And then I got Sgt. Pepper's, and I remember some of the songs on that album scared me.
Yeah.
Like, as a kid, because I didn't know.
Like, She's like, Leaving Home is kind of dark,
yeah,
right?
And I was also like, who are these guys, you know, on the inside cover? They don't look like the Beatles. Like,
right.
Who are these guys?
Right.
So, you know, I feel like the Beatles have been there from the very beginning. I'll never forget, real quick, a friend of my father's telling him when he heard that I was listening to more of the Beatles than, like, the R&B at the time. He was like, no, don't do that. He's going to learn the wrong rhythm.
Oh, no.
He's going to learn that other rhythm. But thankfully, I learned a bunch of different rhythms. Yeah. So, you know.
I've heard you clap. You're on the
Oh, yeah. The one and threes. I actually literally had to, like, sit there and think. Yeah. I was like, where's the one? Where's
you
the three?
Got to do the two and four.
That didn't become
a
thing.
You're a backbeat guy.
I will also say one of the first things I remember from, you know, my earliest memories was John Lennon being shot and dying and seeing, like, all these people react to that. And I knew something very bad had happened.
Right.
And I remember that year I asked my parents for a Beatles birthday cake. And so I saved the little figurines from that cake and played with them like toys. You know, that was my toys. I just had my little Beatles, you know, toys, which I think are still in a closet somewhere. But yeah, that's sort of like, I came into the Beatles pretty damn early in life. That's me. What do the Beatles mean to you?
I can relate to everything you just said so hard. Like, from the idea of the Beatles just being like wallpaper on planet Earth. It's just like, they're always there. They've always been there. And they've always felt like this larger than life entity. They're not just a musical group. They're a cultural phenomenon. It's like Coca-Cola and blue jeans and the Beatles. The first two things being American, I guess. But as a British export, they represented this idea of musicness, but also groupness, because they were four guys. Like, you were talking about your birthday cake with that's important. The figurines, like, you kind of, like, them as people were connected to
I
them.
I licked the icing off, and, like, they were officially toys.
But that was there from day one for everybody, from what I understand. Like, in 1962, 63, they start giving interviews, and they're charming and funny, and they're really fast with the comebacks. Like, someone will try to, you know, borderline insult them to their face.
Yeah.
Like, there's some interview where Paul's being interviewed, and the guy's like, so what do you think your cultural impact will be? And right away, Paul's, like, so sharp. He's like, is this a joke? Cultural impact? We're just having a laugh. I mean,
my favorite response of all time is, are you a mod or you're a rocker? I'm a mocker. You know, like,
and it's so effortless.
And they come up with these things on the fly.
And they absolutely, like, whenever they're in front of a crowd of, like, reporters, they just, like, absolutely win them over. They melt the hearts of the entire nation and the world. And we grow up many years later on a different continent, and we still have that impact on us. And you're in Atlanta, right? And I'm in San Francisco. Like, this is crazy that their impact, and even in 2023, like, their impact culturally only grows with time. The impact only grows with time.
You know what's interesting is that I think it's one of those things that can only come about when you have more than one mind come together. And I think we're going to talk a lot about the idea of these guys, specifically John and Paul, but the other guys too, you know, all throwing in, you know, you and I are in a partnership. I have a writing partner. Like, the idea of like working with somebody else to create something more than what one person could come up with. Like,
absolutely,
I think
yeah.
John would have always had a successful music career. Paul, I mean, the man is a hit machine.
Right.
You know, George might have had an amazing career, but at the end of the day, the fact that they all were able to come together, and yes, Ringo, we're going to talk about Ringo.
I was going to say, you left one out, but we're going to get
to
that.
We're going to talk about Ringo. Yeah. Like, I think there's something to be said about collaboration.
Right.
You know, in the arts, and even right. if you hate the other person, we know that, you know, we know how this story right. ends. Even when you can't get along with the other person, whether it's the Beatles or it's Outkast or whoever,
totally.
Like the idea that you can sit down with somebody else and create something is truly special.
And by the way, I mean, we're going to get to so much today, but even the phenomenon of how sometimes that is short-lived, the duration, it just can't last past, in the Beatles case, 7-8 years they're together. Outkast, I don't know how many total years. Like a lot of these wonderful relationships, they have kind of a beginning and an end point. And yeah. then the personalities that have been fiery, making beautiful art for all these years, just it combusts and goes, you know, it
Absolutely.
Can't last. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, let's get into it. This song, Come Together, the first song off Abbey Road, the 11th Beatles album from 1969. It's a song that came about when Lennon met Timothy Leary at a bed-in, and it's been covered by everyone from Tina Turner to Michael Jackson. Get ready to shoot some Coca-Cola. It is Come Together.
I'll tell you, from the first time I ever heard this song, I always felt like there was something evil going on. Like, there's all kinds of, like, weird imagery. Like,
it's very dark, yeah.
Juju eyeball.
Right.
You know, grooving up slowly always sounded a little bit sneaky. And,
yeah,
and,
spinal
and
cracker.
Holy roller. Like, you know, it felt like, you know, the Louisiana Beatles or something
right.
like that.
They're
there was swampy. Always something going on there.
Something real swampy going on. We're going to actually talk about the swampiness.
I didn't even know. I mean, who's Flat Top?
So many questions. And why is he grooving up slowly? Well, there might be a reason why it's Flat Top. And part of that comes from Lennon's love for one of his favorite musicians, which was Chuck Berry. And
yep.
the origin of this song, the genesis is kind of like some dovetailing ideas coming together for him. One was he was writing a campaign song for Timothy Leary's campaign
yeah.
for governor of California, and the slogan was Come Together.
Imagine how different California would have turned out if Timothy Leary
Instead of Reagan,
had won in 1970.
Right.
I mean, like, could have been a different decade.
Could have been a different planet Earth, yeah,
because yeah.
then it was Reagan who won and went on to become president. So a lot of things could have been different with a Leary administration. So Lennon is turning this phrase around in his mind. And as a songwriter, I recognize this. You're kind of walking around with like a bunch of fragmented ideas. And then you sit down one day and it's like you're in the studio and it's like, what do I got? You look at your phone where you've got like, you know, text, you know, notes with different ideas. In the back of Lennon's mind, he's got this phrase he's turning over. And then this groove that he starts riffing on the guitar in the studio. And what comes out of his mouth is Here Come Old Flat Top Grooving Up Slowly, that first line, which we just heard. And as he plays it, McCartney goes, wait a second, I feel like I've heard that before. And sure enough, it comes from this.
Yeah, come on, Flat Top, he was moving up with me. Then come waving goodbye in a little old souped-up jitney. I put my...
Now that...
Nice.
...is very similar. Would you say that sounds similar?
Yeah, I mean, like, I had no idea. Clearly, I'm not listening to enough Chuck Berry when I'm driving around.
Yeah, I mean, Lennon is the fanboy. And literally, I think in his way of thinking. Now, this is a big topic. And as you probably yep. know, if you've heard the show or seen my TikToks, my favorite topic is the origins of creativity and where does it cross the line from being an homage to his hero, Chuck Berry, versus you are ripping Chuck Berry off.
And also, like, the yeah. whole tradition of white artists taking from black artists.
There's
some
intersectionality
sort of
going on here
yeah,
in a big way. And
repackaging. I like the rebranding
yeah.
of stealing, if you will. But I actually don't even yeah. think of this as stealing.
Yeah.
Go
well,
ahead.
Well, I agree, but yeah. go. I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, here's my thing. I'm a big hip-hop fan, and we've talked about this on the show before. Jay-Z starts off, I just want to love you. When the Remy's in the system, ain't no telling, will I... Or I diss them, that's what they be yelling. You know, Drake starts off For Free, the song For Free with I go on and on, can't understand how I last so long, I must have superpowers, rap 23. You know, like, in both cases, Jay-Z is going off of an old Biggie riff,
yes.
Drake is going off of an old Too Short song.
Right.
Like, you know, I think the idea of, like, Interpolating. Can I do that?
You absolutely can.
I think I just owe you like
$1,000. It's okay. You don't owe me anything.
But I think the idea of taking like just a snippet of somebody else's lyrics sort of as an homage, or I would even argue a continuation. I mean, like, if it's dope, just I feel like that's okay. And I feel like in a weird way, Lennon has done this before hip hop makes this common practice. Does that make sense?
You're like, absolutely defining what his mindset is. So he is absolutely thinking, I'm not doing this. So actually, let me be clear. We don't know what he was thinking. I would speculate that he was doing two things at once and probably justifying it a little bit. He was taking the melody, and I'll show you in a second just how close they are. It's a little bit so close.
Well, it's a lot fast. Chuck Berry's also totally different. Yeah. Like that cadence is crazy and crazy.
Let's
fast.
Pause right there and I'll play it for you, and then let's get into that. So here is a one-to-one comparison of the two. And what they did, so just to finish the story, and this goes into the collaboration thing. So Lennon's in the mindset of, listen, I love Chuck Berry. This is an homage to him. I don't think I'm fooling anyone. It's the same notes. It's the same, you know, basically lyrics. And McCartney's like, yeah, and it crosses a line and we're going to get nicked and there's going to be a repercussion. So they had that dynamic. We'll tell the end of the story in a minute. But just for now, here's what McCartney's hearing. So I'm going to play John Lennon's vocal isolated from Come Together by the Beatles. And then after that, I'm going to play Chuck Berry's isolated vocal from You Can't Catch Me. And then I'll do kind of a slowed down and pitched down comparison so you can hear more directly how they're related.
Here come old flat top, he come grooving up slowly, he got...
Okay, now for comparison, here's Chuck Berry. And again, this is slowed down, so it's a little different, but it is rhythmically and melodically the same, and I'll make that really clear after I play this.
Here come a flat top, he was moving up with me, then come...
So this is the part, and there's another conversation to be had about doing what I'm doing, because there is an argument in musicological circles that it's a little bit cheating, and in court it's an audience, it's a jury convincing device that may or may not be fair. I personally am doing it here because I do think it's fair in this case, but here's what it is. I'm now going to slow down Come Together and pitch it down so that it matches the key. Come Together is in D, we're going to go into A, and here's what that sounds like. Now this is layering Chuck Berry and John Lennon, and you'll just hear that they're dead on the same.
Listen, I think there's obviously, he was obviously taking that part from Chuck Berry, but I will say the Chuck Berry song is fast, his is slow.
Yeah.
And again, he's just doing what I think, you know, especially again, coming in a more hip hop centric era, is still acceptable. I actually think that, and this is just my theory, one of the great tragedies of John Lennon's death, among all the tragedies of it, is that he dies in 1980 in New York.
Yeah.
I feel like John would have had such a great time with hip-hop.
Yes.
And I've always felt that way.
You're
like,
right.
He is the walrus. He is the walrus. Like, if you go back and listen to I Am the Walrus, I'm serious, at the end of the song, when he's going, chuba, 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 and then, like, it's either his voice or Ringo's voice is in the background going, ha, ha. Ha,
yeah.
ha, ha, ha. It almost sounds like hop, hop, everybody, hop, hop. Like, I'm like, this dude would have loved hip hop.
He's proto hip hop.
John Lennon would have loved it. I think he would have loved the attitude of it. Mm-hmm. I think he would have, almost all the great John songs have like this real percussive quality to the singing. Like in this song, it's like he's basically going pop, 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 you know, like I Am the Walrus, dun, 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 dun. Like, you know, he comes with that force.
Rhythmic, yeah, it's very rhythmic.
I just think that rhythmic force, I think he would have loved hip-hop, and he was almost there.
Stop presses. It's not the 50th anniversary. It's the 55th anniversary of hip-hop, and it begins right here with this gentleman. No, that's interesting. That's a great connection that you made.
I think you would have loved it. I think you would have loved the attitude, the anti-establishment tone of it. I wish that those two things could have met.
Clearly, he loves appropriating black artists, so there's also
likes,
that factor.
He does like a black artist. Yeah. When we come back, we're going to go even deeper into this song, so stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody.
Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Save big money on everything for your spring projects at Menards. We have all of your garden and landscaping essentials. Master Garden Premium Garden Soil contains a slow-release fertilizer that feeds gardens for up to 9 months. It produces better results and is ready to use for all your gardening needs. Save big on Menards' great selection of garden and landscaping products. Compare brands in-store or online at Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to One Song. All right, so let's get into the song. Let's get into the stems. Let's get deep. I'm going to start with Ringo's isolated drums. Now, these were recorded where he's got tea towels on the kit to make it really dry. And Diallo, you were saying earlier, we were talking a little bit about that swampy vibe.
Yeah.
And the slowing it down.
It's like a smoky mezcal.
Oh my God, you're making me thirsty. That's actually my favorite beverage right now.
Is it?
Is my favorite alcoholic beverage is a smoky mezcal. They got a great one.
I wish we had a sponsor right now.
Palm Springs Ace Hotel. Yeah. Sponsor us, one. And two, great smoky mezcal if you're out there. So that is an unpaid sponsorship. Go squeeze them for dollars, Eric. Mike. So we were also talking a minute ago about like how to change the song from the original Chuck Berry. Now they're in cahoots. Now the partnership, mm-hmm. Lennon-McCartney. Who do you want to be in this story? You're McCartney. You're Paul. We're in cahoots. We're like, okay, we're doing this, John, because you insist, and it is a great tune, but we've got to kind of make it different from what you're ripping off. We've got to start to hide elements of how the song is similar.
Yeah.
Well, we're doing a key change. They already did that. We went from A to D. And A major to D minor. D seventh? Well, whatever it is, it's D. And we're also going to slow it down. That swampiness, that kind of New Orleans vibe comes from a conscious effort to slow, like the tempo is slower and more lugubrious. So that begins with, and let's make the beat.
Thesauruses, guys.
And let's make the beat not doom, doo, 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 doo. Let's make it tom-toms and let's make it kind of abstract. So Ringo kills it with what he comes up with.
This is one of his best songs.
This is an unusual beat. It's tom-toms and kick drum. It's so minimal. He's like just getting out of the way.
I've always felt like one of the things that makes Ringo special is that he does not get in the way. I think that if he was more of a showboat drummer, you know, like people are like, oh, he can't hold a candle to Keith Moon. I'm like, that wasn't his job. You know what I mean? Like,
100%.
You can't have four people all try to share the spotlight at one time. That's not what the band was. I mean, like, George has his, you know, he's sort of like the spiritual center. These are things that have been said a million times, but I think, you know, let's talk a little about, I want to pause here to talk about the legacy.
I'm so glad you're doing
this. Ringo
Ringo needs his flowers.
No, I really do, because, you know, there's this quote that I think that most music nerds have heard. Apparently some interviewer asked John Lennon, is Ringo Starr the best drummer in the world? And Lennon says he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles. Now, that quote has been disproved. It's not real. Lennon never said that. But where do you stand on this? Was he a great drummer, or do you think of him as the fourth most talented member of one of the best bands ever?
So I have a really strong position about this, and it comes from my own experience as a musician. At the top of the show, you may have heard me. I was playing guitar. I am proudly a decent instrumentalist across the board, and that comes from the fact a little bit that because punk rock existed in my life when I was growing up, it was okay not to be great.
Yeah.
So there is still in the world a very loud voice about technique and talent and these conversations. And there's, I think, an overemphasis. By the way, I also came up, so punk rock was thankfully in my background, but in the world in the 80s, there was Eddie Van Halen and Yngwie Malmsteen and just like fast, perfect. And so those are really conflicting forces. And I think the second one tends to win too often, the perfectionism, the bigness,
the loudness.
I'm glad
we're talking about technique because, you know, like there are drummers who are better technicians.
Yeah.
But I think of Ringo as a creator. I think of him as a creator. Okay. He's a creative partner. He's there to set the mood
of the song. To serve the
song,
that's right.
To serve the song. He's not there to be the most technically perfect drummer. He's there to serve the song. And can you imagine? I mean, like, this song has been covered from by everybody from Ike Turner to Michael Jackson to Godsmack. Like, everybody, Junkie XL. So many people have covered this song, and yet almost nobody changes the drums. And why? Because you can't imagine this song without that distinct drum. I'd even go so far.
It's a huge part of the character of the song. It would be not boring, but it wouldn't be...
And listen,
the vibe.
I mean, like, I don't think any of us, again, we're not saying he's the greatest drummer of all time. I love Ringo Starr. I'll tell you, there's this Quincy Jones story.
Oh, I love
about,
this. Yeah, yeah.
You know this story, but like Quincy Jones, you know, apparently, you know, he was being very truthful and remembering some things.
He's like, this is the iconic Quincy interview that like everything came out.
Everybody was like, ooh, somebody.
And then later they tried
Quincy's
to get him to walk
say,
it back.
Tell him to stop talking.
But it was all truth.
I love this story. So Ringo's in the studio at the same time as a bunch of black jazz drummers. And I've heard Hetfield.
James Hetfield from Metallica?
Yeah. I've heard so many people say the best drummers.
Yeah.
From a technical point of view, are the jazz drummers. They can do things that, you know, like a lot of the rock drummers are like, I don't know how you freaking accomplish that.
Hetfield will come back to this conversation in a minute, but
yes,
go on.
Yes, we will. So, you know, Quincy says that there are all these, you know, wonderful black jazz drummers in the studio, and Ringo's struggling to record his part on some song, and he's like, oh, you know what, I'm going to go across the street and get something to eat. And so he leaves, and then one of them gets on, and it's like, hey, man, he tells the studio engineer, hey, man, fire it up, I'm going to play this part. And he plays it perfectly, like, the first time. And then they go back, and then Ringo returns. He's like, hey, can you play me back my last take? And the engineer, being mischievous, plays him the take that the jazz drummer played. And Ringo's like, oh, you know what? That doesn't sound that bad at all. And the jazz drummer's like, because it ain't you, motherfucker!
That's fucking genius.
I mean, like, so,
I love that.
Again, it's not always about being... You know, I would put this in my own career. There have been comedy writers who I think are the perfect comedy writer. They can carry a script from the blank page to a perfectly finished, you know, 36-page script.
Yeah.
But they're not always the writer you hire to be in that room, because when you're in that room, when you're collaborating with all these people,
it's right person for the right job, right situation.
You want somebody who's throwing out unique ideas, even if they're not always the person to carry it from the blank page to the 36th page, you know, because some people just have crazy outside the box ideas.
It's the right circumstance for the right person, the right role. It's all got to be very specific to the situation. And Ringo's specificity to the Beatles, like if you ever listen to early interviews, the apocryphal Lennon diss aside, like it was, they actually did not feel that way. Don't forget, like Pete Best famously, by the way, not the only fifth Beatle, there was Stu Sutcliffe. But Pete Best was replaced by Ringo Starr, and the story goes that it took place in a situation where once he sat down at the kit and started playing, they all instantly had chills because what Ringo brought to what the Beatles were doing was perfect.
Yeah.
And that's why they kept using him for a reason.
I have another fun drummer aside.
Okay.
Do you know the Beatles song, It's Getting Better All the Time? It's getting better all the time.
Sure.
Do you know the story?
I don't. That's from Sergeant Pepper.
Ringo got sick and missed a couple of dates, and they had to bring on another drummer. This is actually during Beatlemania.
Okay.
They had I forget the
guy's
name.
Oh, it's a tour, right? Yeah,
it was during the tour. And after every gig, this guy kind of wanted the job so bad, he would always tell John and Paul, he's like, hey, I think it's getting better all the time.
Oh, no way. So, that's where that line comes from?
Yeah, that's great. So Paul starts penning a song called It's Getting Better All the Time.
Oh, my God.
And famously, John pokes his head, and he hears him singing this chorus, It's Getting Better All the Time. John pokes it, he's like, it can't get no worse.
Yeah, that's great.
Which to me encapsulates so much of what makes the Beatles special.
That's the partnership between them is exactly, it's moments like that. And famously, their partnership, and famously, all their songs are credited to Lennon McCartney. But really what's happening is they're kind of writing their own songs and bringing them to the group. And the contribution from the other person is often as little as what you just said. I don't know if in that story, McCartney wrote everything else and Lennon just... But that was enough make the collaboration a 50-50 partnership. Another great story, which I love, is, you know that song, It's always funny because it's a similar thing. McCartney writes the kind of sunny, shiny, major key, happy lyrics in another
a day
song.
In a Life is a classic example. Yeah.
We Can Work It Out is another one. Gotta see it my way. Da, 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 da. We can work it out. We can work it out. And then Lennon comes in the
middle. Life is very short
and there's no time. And it's
for fussing and fighting.
It's so funny and it's dark and it's minor. And then we're back to Paul, sunny and happy.
The classic is woke up, jumped out of bed.
Right.
Red comb across my head. The other guy's talking about blowing his brains out in a car.
Blowing his mind out in his car. Right. Time and time again, that's the nature of the Lennon McCartney.
Absolutely.
Interaction is a little bit of yin to the yang, a little bit of darkness to the light.
But just to close out on Ringo, I think it's a classic example of why a partnership is different than a solo mission.
Totally.
And, you know, the only thing I hold against Ringo Starr is Octopus's Garden. It's one of my least favorite Beatles songs.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade.
It's not
sorry,
a good song.
Ringo. But I think that, you know, he was a great collaborator and he brought so much to this song and others.
And just to put a final touch also on the whole giving Ringo his flowers, I think he's in a group with two other drummers that I just want to defend in public.
Okay.
So I'm ready to do it.
Here we go.
I'm going out on a limb.
Here
it's not even a limb. It shouldn't be a limb.
No, this is a limb.
This is the limb. Okay. Ringo, Meg White from the White Stripes.
Okay.
And frankly, we were talking about Metallica. Frankly, Lars Ulrich from Metallica, these are three drummers that just like are notoriously always singled out as being like that guy. You know, imagine if the band didn't have this jerk dragging things down. But it's
anybody would drag the Metallica drummer. I didn't know that.
Lars is famously considered like kind of lead footed, like he's like kind of not doing the fills are a little corny or whatever it is. But like Metallica without Lars wouldn't be Metallica. And I'm a big Metallica fan.
Well, there you go.
And I love the fact that what he brings into the situation is kind of a Ringo-esque, not the technical guy, but the idea guy. He's serving the song. He's also a co-songwriter. He's also just a force within the band to like, let's go, let's win, let's be number one. Like, that's what Lars brings to the band. And if you had some like hired gun who was incredible technically, I think frankly it wouldn't be as heartfelt. And last but not least in my like triumvirate, my holy trinity of drummers that deserve
underrated
more flowers.
Drummers.
Underrated drummers. Meg White is, they're a two-piece band. Jack White is playing guitar. There's no bass player. It's this sort of bluesy, kind of cute. It's got the colors. That whole package works because Meg is playing from a willfully, I don't want to say naive, but I think it really is sort of consciously naive in the sense that Jack heard her and it's like, that's what this situation needs.
Right.
So it's not to diss her or throw under the bus to call her drumming simplistic and naive. That's on purpose. She wasn't a great drummer, but that's what the White Stripes needed to be a great band.
Let me tell you, you went out on that limb, and you are nesting, my friend. You are nesting on that limb. Rockin' Robin.
I'm proud of it, too.
There
you go. I'll stand by those words.
I can't think about this song without thinking about the keys in it. That Rhodes, like that super, we've used swampy and smoky. I'm running out of adjectives, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Can you tell me anything about that?
Yeah, that super bluesy solo, which, why don't we play it, and then we'll talk about
it.
Let's listen. You know, as we listen to that right now, I'm just reminded of how just a few months prior to them recording this song, Come Together, in mid-69, they had just brought Billy Preston into the band to collaborate on the song Get Back, which is actually the only Beatles song where it's the Beatles with Billy Preston.
Uh-huh. Like,
so this is an American keyboard player, if you don't know. In the song Get Back, there's this wonderful Rhodes solo and part and the rooftop concert. So this was a Black American keyboard player who they had met with Little Richard in Hamburg. He was in the back of their mind, and they bring him in to kind of inject the band with some new energy.
The second that they brought in a Black man, the Beatles broke up. Messed up.
That's not something I'd ever considered before. So I'm thinking about that because hearing this is a very Billy Preston-esque thing to play, this rhythmic part on a Rhodes. And just a few months earlier, they were so excited by Billy Preston playing the Rhodes. So
there you go.
It just kind of occurs to me that there may be a connection there. But a funny thing also about this part is that originally, McCartney was kind of the better technical player, especially on keyboards. Mm-hmm. And so Lennon sat him down and kind of said, you know, kind of gave him a description of what he wanted. And McCartney plays this part, and Lennon's like, that's wonderful. I love that. And then he erases McCartney's take and does it himself. He just rips off what McCartney does wholesale. So that's McCartney's idea recorded by Lennon that we just heard.
That, I mean, that's the crazy thing about a partnership is that you have to kind of know what the lines are. Like, yeah. You know, there's some...
Right.
And by the way, it's like any kind of like long-term relationship. Like some things become completely sore subjects, you know, to never bring them up. And then other things like, you know... Lennon knew that he could replace McCartney's part on that, and it wasn't going to blow up the relationship. Are you a Lennon or McCartney guy?
Well, I'll answer that in a second, but you're absolutely right. But what's funny to think about is in 1963, that may have been tolerated, but maybe in mid-69, when they're like Lennon's about to leave the band a few minutes later, like maybe this wasn't the best timing for him to have done that. But so back to the question. This is a question we all grow up in.
By the way, I don't think it's a binary choice. You don't have to be. I'm just curious if you are.
You know, because it is such a part of our cultural landscape, you get these sense of, like, McCartney's the cute one, the melody one. He's the sort of like song and dance guy, you know, like 30s musical kind of influences. He's the, you know.
That's because of Lady Madonna, I'm sure.
It's among other things. Yeah. And Eleanor Rigby, you know, he's the one who brings strings indirectly with George Martin's help. And Lennon's the cool one, the angry one. The one who's really into the blues and American music, and then Ringo's
Ringo was like the child. When I was a child, to me, I was like, oh, Ringo's like their cool little brother who gets to play with the band.
And he's kind of the peacemaker.
And he's kind of the oldest member of the band. He's older than the other three.
You're right. And he ends up in Get Back, you'll see how much of a peacemaker he is. He's just like he's serving the song, he's just there to serve the band.
In a weird way, he was the journeyman in the group. I'll say for me, growing up, I was always like a Lennon guy. He seemed cool. He seemed like the leader.
Yeah.
You know, when I got to my 20s and I started to deconstruct music in my head and sort of go off the, you know, off into just music construction, I really grew to appreciate Paul. I was actually sad that I had been a drummer and not a bassist because whether it was the Beatles or Daft Punk or most of my favorite hip-hop songs, the bass line was always what drew me in. Totally. And I was always like, oh, man, people who can play the bass, that's like pure magic. Now I feel like I'm legitimately like a person who respects everybody's contribution.
I'm so glad you landed there because I was thinking about how I didn't answer the question because I couldn't. As I was going through the whole thing, it's like, I like my mom. I like my dad. Like, I can't just pick one. It's a Sophie's choice to pick a Beatle.
But hey, backing up. Listen, I will say this. The Shoot Me. Can we hear a little bit of the vocals? Because I will say, growing up, and even up until you did a TikTok video about it, I never knew he said Shoot Me.
Now I
always thought it was Shoop Doop. I thought it was just like some scatting or something.
I may overuse the word chilling in this room, in this context, and I'm sorry, but this is the chillingest of all, is hearing what Lennon was actually saying, because it's actually a little bit covered up. You can't really tell. It just sounds like shh, right? You can't really hear the whole thing. But he is actually saying, shoot me, and here's Lennon's isolated vocals from that section. And as you
now, there's a sound over the me, clearly, and I still don't really hear Shoot Me.
He's
like,
clapping.
This is the Yanni, whatever that thing was.
Yanni
the
and
internet.
Laurel.
Yeah.
It's go like ahead. We were saying a second ago, what you're hearing there is a couple things. One, you're hearing Lennon with delay on his vocals. Mm. It's kind of like his hero Elvis got the slap back in the room.
Yeah,
he wanted
that
all the time, but he's also, because he's not playing guitar, his hands are free, and he's clapping. So he's saying, shoot me. And they're both going through this delay, and it becomes this kind of layered, denser noise that makes the lyrics a little harder to make
out. Wow, yeah, because I got to say, I still don't hear Shoot Me. But, you know, I feel like if I'm really listening for it, I can kind of pretend it's there.
Well, and also we know it's there because it was another phrase he'd been turning in his head for another song that incomplete and never was released.
And to people who wonder about these things, he was saying Shoot Me probably as a heroin reference. And all the people who were into like the Paul is dead theory thought it was, they killed Paul. They shot him, you know, like there's, and then obviously there's the ultimate irony that doesn't even really need to be stated.
Need to be said. But...
You know, yeah, it's crazy that he said, shoot me.
But I will say his death in 1980 affected all of us at the time.
Yeah.
But I remember somebody had, because I was really little, but somebody had spray painted it, John Lennon, 1940 to 1980, right by our house, like on a wall near us. So for years, we would drive past that, and it just embedded in my head this idea of John Lennon, 1940 to 1980. As I grow up, I'm like, that age, 40, gets more and more like, wow, that is the tragedy of it only being 40 years old. So that wonderful story about Lennon and McCartney kind of quasi-fighting over who gets to play the keyboard part, or maybe there wasn't a fight. Maybe Lennon was just like, hey, yo, it's my song. Thanks for the idea. Take a hike. Go walk around the block and have a cigarette break.
Yeah.
It really gets to the heart of the tension, of potentially the tension in a creative partnership.
There can be tension.
There's a lot of trust that you build, but there's also probably resentments. There's all kinds of emotions that go
into from 10
it.
Years ago that didn't get resolved.
I mean, you of all people, you and Bashir have been writing partners for like 20-something years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I've known him since... known him since 1994.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. I mean, that's beautiful. I mean, that all these years later, you're still writing.
Well, yeah,
together.
I mean, like, we always call it going to the, we're always down to, like, we may argue, but we generally are, like, down to get back on the playground and, you know, after 10 minutes of anger. Listen, I think that, yeah, partnerships, there can be tension there. I think that in the case of me and Bashir, we've worked on many TV shows and projects and commercials and all kinds of stuff. I think it's always trying to show the other person mutual respect. I would never try and figure out, like, who's the Lennon or who's the McCartney in that partnership. Because, no, seriously, I think there are things that I do, without getting specific, I think there are things that I do in our collaborations that are, you know, specific to me and my talents. And I think that there are wonderful, wonderful things that he does that I'm like, oh, shit, how did he do that? You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think there's still, in the best relationship, sort of this fascination with how did that person pull off that magic? I think as long as that's there, the relationship is healthy. At some point, if one of them is like... that person's not doing anything I can't do. Well, then that's when things can start to crumble. But I think, thankfully, we haven't reached that place. By the way, you and I are in a partnership.
Right. Well, we're like in
earlier.
We're
doing stuff right now.
Well, go ahead. But it's funny because it's like there's so many parallels to relationships and marriages, too. Yeah. It's like, you know, over time, two people that, first of all, on day one were the way they were, but like they evolved differently. And you've got to sort of make sure that you bring it back and, you know, check in with the other person. There's emotional stuff that happens behind the scenes when you're making art and making TV shows and music. So it's interesting to think about like how similar it is to like relationships. And
I'm always trying to figure out in our relationship who's the Lennon and who's the McCartney.
Oh,
I have my theories.
Who's the violent? No, see, we can't. There's too
we're
many.
We're not saying anybody's violent.
That's
but
too
who's
much.
The cutting sarcastic
one? I think we both
one.
Would like to think, look, it's challenging. The image of Lennon is cool. The reality of his story is far more complicated. We don't need to get into all the things that made him an imperfect person.
Yeah.
McCartney is a lovable, literally a living legend. We both have a shared friend. Shout out to Chris Holmes, our buddy, who literally is his DJ. Our friend's job is to go on tour with Paul McCartney and be his DJ. So the idea...
He's now the fifth Beatle.
He is not... Chris, you're the fifth Beatle. I don't think it's an easy answer, but I think we're both
McCartney. But I think I'm George.
Oh, okay. I'm George is like the younger one. Well, you are the younger one between the two of us.
And what was the other A-side to this Come Together single, but Something?
Right, it all comes together.
Comes together.
Harrison's probably most beloved composition. It's been covered, like,
by
Come Together's been
people.
Covered by, whatever, 300 people. I think Something may have been covered by 3,000, including Frank Sinatra. Like, so, this is the partnership. If you're the George and I'm the Paul, I can live with that. I can live with
that. Oh, you claim Paul?
Oh, wait, I thought you just
forget
said you,
you
claimed
man.
George.
You were supposed to say...
Now I'm seeing that violent Lennon side come out in you.
You're supposed to say George Martin. Nobody's supposed to claim Lennon or Paul McCartney. Speaking of Lennon, let's talk about his vocals.
Let's talk about him.
Hold you in his arms, yeah, you can feel his disease. Come together right now over me. Shoot.
That's it. It's a short chorus. It's
wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. You know, one of the things I love about this song are the lyrics. You know, even though I said earlier that, like, you know, it sounded spooky and a little bit scary to young me, like, it actually has some of the things that I appreciate the most about, especially, like, the John sort of lyrically driven songs, which is... They have a sort of nonsensical
sort of
quality.
Dada-esque, right,
it reminds me of David Byrne in Talking Heads, who, you know, famously says stop making sense to himself while recording a song.
Yes.
Because he was like, oh, you're making too much sense. Like, I love that. But I will say, growing up, I thought that each verse was about a different Beatle.
Oh,
I thought each verse was... So I thought that, Holy Roller, Juju Eyeball, it was all about, like, spirituality. So I thought that was George.
George, right.
I thought, you know, obviously Bag Production, Spinal Cracker being a reference to the car accident he got into when Yoko was pregnant.
Oh, man.
I thought that was about John. He's so good looking, but he's so good looking.
Got to be good looking.
Got to be good looking.
Hard to see.
Because he's so hard to see. Yeah. I thought that was Paul.
Okay.
You know, before we did this episode, I went back and I read him. And now I actually think that every verse might be about John.
Okay.
You know, I could be wrong about this, because I don't see where the stuff in the second verse is about Ringo at all, unless there's just some part of Ringo's personality that we don't know. But yeah, for most of my life, I thought each verse was about a different Beatle.
Yeah.
And then now I don't know, you know.
That's an interesting take. I never considered any of that. Really, really smart.
Yeah. Anyway. That's the stuff I be thinking about when I'm listening to the Beatles. I do feel like Come Together is one of those songs that has like a universal appeal.
Right.
You know, I feel like you can play it for people who claim to not like the Beatles. And there's so many. Shout out to all the people who don't like the Beatles. I think that's a perfectly fine position to take. It's not my position, but like, you know, nobody should force you to like the Beatles. But I do feel like this is one of those songs that truly has a universal appeal to so many different types of genres of music.
But if I can piece both of what you just, those two ideas together, what's interesting is, and this as a songwriter, I know this from experience, like you can get away with an awful lot in the verse in terms of the storytelling where it doesn't all have to make sense. It should tell a story, it should be evocative, but a lot of it sometimes is just like throwing a phrase out that's very specific, or just a line that you know everyone's going to love. Feet down below his knees.
Yeah.
It doesn't
necessarily... Feet down below his knees. It sounds like, wait a second.
Self-evident.
We all have feet below his knees.
It's not very special.
Yeah. What's your favorite lyric in the song?
I mean, I think it's hard because one and one and one is three.
Such a good line.
It's a great one.
Such a... One and one and one is... Like, it's like... that, again, repetition, when it works, that shit powers.
And it's like almost a self-evident, it's like ironically delivered, but accurately, truthfully delivered. Because it's like kind of like, it's so powerful, the delivery. Like, this is an important thing I'm saying, but it's like, this is the thing that every two-year-old knows at the same time.
By the way, I think it's apparently the only Lennon-McCartney song to never go number one anywhere. The song One and One is Two. And it was written by Paul McCartney, and it comes in the verse that I thought was about Paul McCartney. It comes in, it's in that last verse that ends with the Got to Be Good Looking. So
there's a song called One and One is Two.
One and One is Two.
I don't know that one.
And it was a song that was rejected.
So,
you know, like some of their songs were rejected for the group. So they gave them to other people, and they usually went on to do pretty good for those other groups. Yeah. But I think that's got the record as like the worst Beatles, you know, Beatles written song of all time or something like that.
In the verse, you can almost do whatever you want as long as in the chorus you land with something big, simple, universal.
Yeah.
And two words come together. What an idea that, first of all, is easily understood. It's not abstract and Dada-esque and William Burroughs inspired. It's just come together, which, by the way, let's face it, maybe Timothy Leary deserves a little songwriting credit along with, you know.
I just like the lyrics because John is the king of, like, the ironic, like, you know, baby, you're a rich man, you know, like, things like that, you know, got to be good looking because he's so hard to see.
Yeah, he really packs a punch in a, like, little bumper sticker sized chunk.
They're not puns. Well, I don't know what you would call that, but they're humorous.
They're a little clever.
They're humorous
lines.
And they're clever, and
couplets.
I think it speaks to just some humorous couplets from the Lennon himself.
Yeah, yeah.
So many good lyrics in this one. So many lyrics I actually got wrong when I first heard them.
For sure,
you know,
me
there's
too.
That one line like "hold you in his arms till you can feel his disease."
Is that not what he says?
That's what he says. I think like so many people, it's like I heard like "hold you in his armchair" or something like that.
Yeah.
Like
it's you're kinda, right. That's what I thought it was.
Yeah.
I thought it was armchair.
By the way,
not armchair. Okay.
Not to, you know, I am a Nirvana fan, I guess, because a lot of things remind me of Nirvana. And that line about you can feel his disease will always remind me of, you know, wish I could eat your disease till you turn black, you know?
Like, in heart-shaped box.
Disease is not a word that a lot of people have put into a song.
Kind of infects the song with a little bit of like, ugh.
Dark.
Yeah.
Just
little
dark.
Spores. Little mold spores.
Oh, my gosh. Come for talk about music, but stay for references to mold spores.
But it's funny about sound, about lyrics, too, because I'm the kind of person, and I know that there's both, there are people that are lyric-centric, and they're Bob Dylan fans. I'm that's not who I am.
Yeah.
I'm sound first, and I'm, as a musician, performer, DJ, like...
I didn't know we had that in common. There's a part of me, and we'll talk about this on another show, but the Bob Dylan cult, I'm not a part of.
I saw an Elliott Smith show once, and I just, like, fell asleep. Like, I can't do... I'm sound... centric, I think, in the way I listen, and that includes lyrical analysis, where I'll hear something for years and not really notice even that I didn't know what the words were.
Yeah.
And like, even as you were saying it, I could have gone either way. You could have told me that it was armchair. You could have told me it was arms. I mean, like, I don't know even now which.
Listen,
is
I mean, like, it happens all the time. People just still sound think to you me. Said, like, you know,
it just
excuse
phones.
Me while I kiss this guy
right.
instead of kiss
oh
the sky.
Yeah.
You know, we should do a whole segment on what you thought the lyric was and what that lyric actually is. When I was growing up, I thought Boogie Wonderland was Boogie Was a Man. You know, I was like, Boogie Was a Man. I was like, who is Boogie?
Wait, that makes more sense than Boogie Wonderland. That's not a sensical phrase. Boogie Was a Man.
Boogie Was a Man.
Story
that's a story.
The story of Boogie.
No, it's more than that. It goes deep. Boogie was a man, but he's also was a man, so he's dead.
Oh.
You could dive deep on
that's
Boogie.
That's a rich analysis
I
right
know,
there.
I was looking for stories even then.
You know what, my friend, you just made me think. My favorite version of that, it's not even my own story to tell, but our friend from high school, Hannah McElhenney, if you're out there, I love the fact that she always thought that the Michael Jackson song was, take a walk to the post office. Don't stop taking it. I think of that to this day whenever I hear Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. Now,
he was just trying to mail a letter.
By the way,
he was just trying to mail a letter.
But by the way, what the actual lyric is weird too. It's like, with the force don't stop. It's like a Star Wars reference.
He had seen Star Wars. No, a lot of people don't know this. If you take away one thing...
That is a Star Wars song.
Yes, it's a Star Wars song. That's what people don't know about that song. Yeah. And we're not even kidding.
We're not kidding.
So come for the Beatles, stay for the Michael Jackson facts.
This is no joke.
Here's another Michael Jackson fact. He covered Come Together.
What?
When he owned their catalog. When he like sent an email to himself, an early, you know, CC mail email to himself. He's like, hey, can I cover the Beatles? Yes, you can, Michael, because you own that shit.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Famously, the end
cover their whole catalog.
The end of the Michael Jackson Paul McCartney friendship is when Jackson bought out from under McCartney's
nose. He let Nike use
nose.
It in one of the greatest commercials of all time.
The Revolution one,
you know,
yeah.
No, that's it's actually
another Lennon cool. song, great Lennon song. So earlier we were talking about Chuck Berry, and we were also talking about how in the partnership, how John and Paul were sort of like debating, okay, if it is a Nick, if it isn't a Nick, how are we going to get away with it? If this is an homage, is it something that we might get sued for? They had some disagreement about that, and clearly Lennon was like, you know what? All we have to do is slow it down and make some tweaks. And McCartney was like, okay, brother. Sure enough, they got sued by Chuck Berry's publisher, yeah. Morris Levy, who took him to court, and he won. And as part of the settlement, Lennon ended up having to record, ironically, a few songs from Levy's
right.
catalog, including You Can't Catch Me,
yeah,
the Chuck Berry song.
Like in the mid-70s, right?
In the mid-70s, they come out on these kind of lesser-known records that were, you know, pressed up by Levy's kind of cheap... this guy's literally a gangster, by the way.
Does this mean that, like, Chuck Berry didn't own his own publishing, this other guy did? Big Seven Publishing or whatever it's called?
There's so much... This is such a trope that I'm almost embarrassed and annoyed to have to say it, but Morris Levy was a gentleman of whiteness in the music industry who ripped off his black clients, including Chuck Berry, and specifically how he did it, you're dead right. He would literally put his name on the publishing credits so that Chuck Berry wouldn't get his own royalties as a writer
that
on
sucks.
His own material.
Now, is that because nowadays everybody in the business knows about publishing? And is it because that first, like that 50s generation of black artists didn't know about publishing, or were they muscled out?
The simplest answer to a very deeply complicated, not complicated question, but like there's a lot to unpack there, but the simple answer is absolutely not. They were told that this would happen, but that this would happen was a complete lie. And they didn't have the structure, the lawyers, the knowledgeable people with the label owners themselves of color who could tell them, you know what, you should look at this
make
is
sure
not good
that you,
for you.
Have your publisher.
They had no way of knowing. Also, it's earlier in the music industry, so there isn't a lot of like history behind like stories of other people that can say, don't do what I did.
But publishing has been known about since Tin Pan Alley in the 1920s. I mean, like, I have to think at some point these artists knew about publishing. They just, I feel like they were probably muscled out of it.
The specific way in which they were ripped off, I'm sure, varied from situation to situation.
Yeah.
Levy's version was to have them sign whatever the agreement looked like, and then in the background, however the accounting, you know, books were being cooked, just not pay him out what was owed to him. And just to be clear, like, Morris Levy, the publisher, Berry's publisher who sued Lennon, was himself a criminal and was literally had mob ties and was about to serve a prison sentence, and then he died before he could go to jail.
Got off scot-free.
Got off scot-free, as it were, yeah.
Okay, so that was Come Together, the Beatles. We hope you learned some things about the Beatles you didn't know. We hope you learned some things about us you didn't know. Before we take off, everybody's always asked this, Beatles or Stones?
Beatles or Stones? That is the question.
Yeah.
And boy, do I wrestle.
I think I know.
One.
I think I know for you.
Interesting. What do you think my answer is going to be?
Well, I mean, I think you like the Beatles more than the Stones.
So you're technically right, and I do like the Beatles more than the Stones. But like in recent years, I have to say, kind of rising above, because this is all the pantheon of great British rock bands from the '60s. You've got also the Who's in the corner saying, "What about me?"
Zeppelin. Bashir is a huge fan of the Who, by the way.
And then there's Sabbath and Zeppelin and Queen saying, "Hey, we're coming soon. What about us? Yeah. Are we in this conversation?" Actually, from that kind of wider lens, the Kinks in
the
recent
Kinks,
years,
nice.
The Kinks have really
Absolutely.
Been rising.
Love the Kinks.
In my esteem, a band that does not get their due. The Kinks, one of the great British rock bands. We all know "You Really Got Me" and you know "Da Da 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 All Day and All of the Night."
Yeah.
All day.
Which was covered by Two Live Crew masterfully.
4 and 4, we fucked on the floor in the bedroom all day and all of the night.
Five. That was actually the first time I heard that chorus, but keep going.
So for me, the Kinks got robbed basically of their opportunity to be in that question, because it could have been the Beatles versus the Kinks, or it could have been the Stones versus the Kinks. But literally, they went to America in 64, 65. They were bigger, arguably, if not on par, because You Really Got Me was the number one single and their first single. So out of the gate in 64, they're huge. They come to America and they piss off the wrong people because they're brothers fighting, by the way, which is another, right? Back to the collaborations.
Oasis, there you go.
These are two brothers fighting. They're fighting too much. They get kicked out of America and banned for 4 years.
Wow.
They missed the entire 60s British invasion. They are not part of everything where the Beatles come and take over the planet.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's all because they just sort of fought with the wrong like TV producer behind the scenes or something like that.
Okay.
And meanwhile, they're writing all these songs, Waterloo Sunset, that like super inspire McCartney and the Beatles. So they're like a huge influence, undersung. I'm actually going to answer Beatles versus Stones officially. I'm officially saying Kinks.
Okay. I like what you did there. And I'm going to take that ball and say, I think go back and discover The Seeds, because The Seeds are one of my favorite groups from the
60s. I do not even know The Seeds.
The Seeds are really, really cool. Check out a song, Can't Seem to Make You Mine by The Seeds.
Are you going to put them above the Beatles or above the Stones?
No, I'm not putting it.
Okay.
I'm not. I hate comparing groups.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
know
yeah.
this.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't even like comparing genres because
it's so
different.
Painful, yeah.
You know, like
different
you and days. I will talk about, well, who are the Stones of hip hop? Who are the Beatles of hip hop? There are no perfect analogies.
That's
no
the
perfect
third place. Time on this show you've brought that up, saying that you don't like to talk about it. But we love to talk about
clearly,
it.
I'm,
we love
I hate
this
it
game.
So much. I'm in, always fascinated.
Future episodes,
by it.
Stay tuned, because we're going to burn. This is going to have to be
by
a
the
segment.
Way, Outkast is the Beatles of hip hop, only because that is a partnership that did not last as long as some of us.
Does that mean the Stones are the Wu Tang? Wu Tang are the Stones?
That's interesting. I'll think about
we'll
that.
To think about that.
I'll have a good
this
answer.
This is an
by
ongoing
next week.
Discussion.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Dude, that was so much fun. Luxury, help me in this thing.
Let's end this thing. Well, I've been producer and DJ and songwriter Luxury.
And I am the actor, writer, and sometimes DJ with feet below his knees, Diallo Riddle.
And this is one song, Diallo Riddle.
We'll see you next time.
One Song is a SiriusXM and Kevin Hart's LOL Radio production. It's hosted by me, Luxury, and my friend Diallo Riddle. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson, with engineering from Marcus Hom, additional production support from Leslie Guam, Charles Childers, and Alicia Shimada. This show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Weil.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.